protagonist of Peter Mountford's debut novel, A Young Man's Guide to Late Capitalism, is Gabriel de Boya, a young man from California, recently out of college, a Latin American specialist for an American hedge fund. He's staying in La Paz, Bolivia in 2005, earning money beyond his dreams, but leading a double life, pretending to be a simple freelance journalist in South America's poorest country. The book is published by Mariner, and I'm delighted that it brings Peter Mountford to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Despite the fact that hedge funds have been in the news every day for the past couple of years, and we just had a complete discussion about it, do you think that most people have a clue?
I think that there's a better understanding now. When I started writing the book, it was pre-crisis. And I remember in the early draft, I had to really explain to my reader what a hedge fund was. And then history intervened on my behalf, and suddenly it was on the news every night. So I could trim back a lot of that. But I think that there's some understanding of how they function approximately, yes.
But you weren't one of those people who was predicting the crisis, were you?
No, I didn't predict it, no.
What do we need to know about them to understand the situation in your novel?
I think it's not terribly important to understand a lot of the mechanics of a hedge fund to understand the novel. Gabriel's job is essentially he's a researcher. So hedge funds typically play the numbers pretty much. It's all quantitative analysis. But occasionally they also have people who are like political analysts and other types of positions, which are more that are less about the numbers. And you have so that's what his job is to actually research genuine leads, almost like a reporter on the ground and in the countries themselves and find out information that can be useful.
Especially in countries with volatile economies,
yeah.
You have to understand how the political winds are blowing.
Exactly. And you can sometimes find out things from speaking to people in, say, a political party, and they'll tell you something that can't be determined by, you know, algorithms.
Such as we're planning to nationalize the gas industry.
Which is what happens in my novel, yes. And that was a drama that played out. And there's an almost identical drama playing out right now in Bolivia over mining. Evo Morales has said that he's going to nationalize a number of mining companies. And there's companies that have, say, 10% of their operations in Bolivia right now. And as soon as he announced that, their stock price dropped about 10%.
Weren't you in a situation like Gabriel's, but in Ecuador, not Bolivia?
Similar, yeah. I had, after college, I managed to get a job, a really surreal job, as a kind of hack economist for a right-wing think tank. I was sort of one of their token liberals. They paid me very little. I got about $8 an hour. And I
well, a liberal doesn't deserve any more
exactly.
than that.
Exactly. It wasn't useful to me. But I they said you can do almost whatever you want. You're sort of here to give the illusion of balance. And so I wrote about a lot of different things, and it was an entertaining time. And then I said at some point, I had an ex-girlfriend who's living in Ecuador. And so I said, can I go to Ecuador? And they said, really, you can do whatever you want. We don't care.
Did they pay your airfare to Ecuador?
No. But I still got my $8 an hour and while I was down there. And so I started writing about the Ecuadorian economy.
Which is not the same as the Bolivian economy.
Not at all. And at the time, the Ecuadorian economy was in absolute crisis mode. It was a really, really disastrous crisis. Just unbelievable. And they were abandoning their own currency at the time, and they did abandon it, and they use the dollar now there, the U.S. dollar. And so I was there for about a year and a half writing about the economy, and I eventually kind of quit feeling a little dirty and came back to the States and started writing fiction.
Mm-hmm. But you weren't really working for a hedge fund.
No,
An extrapolation from the experience.
Yeah. I mean, I was essentially doing economics and financial forecasting to an extent, yeah.
In Gabriel's case, his qualifications include having a Chilean mother, so he's bilingual.
Mm-hmm.
But what was he doing before he got this job?
Yeah, he was working as a financial reporter. I drew on various experiences in my own life, but I worked for a while for AOL, and it was kind of – he has a job sort of not unlike what I did, which is making not quite enough to live in New York City. And it's he's living in New York City, and so it's sort of a tough life for a guy who's just out of college and has great aspirations, but then reality is sort of disappointing. And then when he gets this offer from this hedge fund to make, you know, ludicrous amounts of money, he feels, first of all, unqualified, but he feels also amazingly lucky to get the job. And so every month, you know, he feels like he's just hoping that he can keep the job for one more month and get another paycheck.
Does this actually happen? Do financial firms send people to places like Bolivia and Ecuador? And
occasionally, they'll do
some of the more volatile countries of
they're often called political analysts, and they'll have some of that, absolutely. And they'll also, I mean, they'll bring in everybody from, you know, former, you know, people from the Defense Department to kind of give advice.
But they're not, I'd imagine that people who go for MBAs, you didn't, but people who go for MBAs are not studying political science as well as preparation for the course, for what they're going to do later.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there are people who obviously that's needed. It's something that has to happen. You need people. If you're an international company, you need to be aware of what's happening politically.
Now, Gabriel is really afraid of being fired.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, that's his.
Just because he thinks he's inadequate to the job.
Yeah. And essentially, and so he hopes that he can basically fool his bosses into keeping him on the payroll for yet another month, because every month he gets this massive paycheck. And I think, you know, he starts off the book quite inept, and as it progresses, he actually learns to be pretty good at what he does.
So he's providing them with valuable information.
And to his own surprise, and definitely to his bosses, I think, as well.
My guest is Peter Mountford, whose novel, A Young Man's Guide to Late Capitalism, is published by Mariner. Bolivia is the poorest country in South America, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Why would an American hedge fund be so interested in it? Because of the volatile political situation there?
No, it's more – I mean, there's a little bit of that. There's an election taking place while he's down there. But it's also that they're not interested in Bolivia. They sent him there specifically because it's – you know, they say it's like one of their Cessnas rather than one of their gold-plated 747s. It's a place that if he messes up, there's no downside, essentially. So it's a test. You know, it's his first assignment, and they want to see if he can handle it. It's a very stressful job, and it's difficult to do.
Well, you wrote recently that, I'm quoting, revolution-prone Bolivia has averaged slightly more than one president per year for the last 186 years. I mean, that's unstable, but Evo Morales has remained in office for quite a while now.
There's been a sea change, I think, throughout a lot of Latin America. I mean, Ecuador had a similar situation, just revolution after revolution. And then I think maybe in the last 10 years, things have quieted down economically and politically in a lot of these countries. There's more stability.
Are you saying revolution or coups, military coups?
Often coups. I mean, that's what I mean. Yeah. There's been revolutions. I mean, a lot of revolutions in Bolivia. The palace where the presidential palace is referred to as Palacio Quemado, which means burnt palace because it's been burnt to the ground like five or six times in the last 100 years.
Well, what's the basis of Bolivia's economy?
There's natural gas now, which is a huge thing. In the future, they actually have a lot of the world's lithium is in salt flats in southern Bolivia. And so there's a hope that they can provide the lithium for our car batteries.
Tin,
yes. They have tin, silver, lots of mining operations.
So that would make it a rich country. Why is it so poor?
Well, there's been a long history. I mean, it's in Bolivia, it's referred to as El Saqueo, which is the history of kind of colonialism and since the Spanish arrived, they built the city of La Paz around a river that was full of gold. I mean, that was why they moved there. And after the gold, they discovered the silver, which actually financed the Spanish Empire for a long, long time. And then tin, and there's just been subsequent things. And I think in the case of most recently, natural gas, which was discovered in the 90s, it became another Spanish company came in actually and took possession of much of that. And now Evo Morales has done his best to nationalize a lot of this. And I think it's improving slightly for them. But
although there has been a lot of conflict, the wealthier people, especially the ranchers, have been offering some resistance. But I guess Evo Morales is a populist and has the support of the majority of the population.
Yeah.
Why is it so important that Gabriel find out whom President Morales is going to pick for his finance minister?
Well, there's a sense that if he can find out, he could perhaps talk to the person before the guy is sort of known to be the finance minister, and he can perhaps get a little bit of a head start by talking to the guy and getting a sense of what the guy's plans are, what his feelings are about things like nationalizing gas, like if he thinks that's actually a viable option. And so Gabriel's, that's sort of one of his missions. He's just trying to find out any kind of information he can before anyone else finds out.
And do they talk to Americans about that sort of thing?
I mean, I think that he comes at the guy as a journalist, and the guy at the time was a professor. And so he's a journalist who's saying, I'm wanting to find out about the country. Can you tell me how you feel as a professor of economics about these issues? So it's a sort of, it seems like it's an abstract conversation rather than he's trying to get policy information from the guy.
Well, when you were in Ecuador, mm-hmm. the government was rather conservative and you were working for a conservative think tank. So mm-hmm. did that help you?
It did not especially help me now. I was very young and in over my head. And I remember my final quest is kind of replicated in the opening of this novel. But my bosses at the think tank wanted me to try and find this what's called an Article 4 report, which is a report written by the International Monetary Fund that really gives a candid assessment of a country's economy. And Ecuador had not published theirs. And so I had to interview the finance minister and the head of the central bank and try and get them to give me a copy. And they, of course, saw through me basically and said, no way.
There's a terrifying incident where a man in the street sets off a stick of dynamite. Was that mm-hmm. based on something that actually happened?
That has happened. Yeah, well, the miners protest a lot. There's a lot of protests in La Paz in general. And when the miners protest, they wear their helmets and they throw dynamite around a bit as a way of – you can hear it. When I was there, you could hear it. You'd hear firecrackers all the time. And then there would be a thunderous explosion, something not like fireworks, and that was dynamite as part of a protest. And people have certainly been wounded. I mean, it's happened.
Gabriel decides to manipulate the price of a stock by starting a rumor.
Mm-hmm.
Is that easier to do in a small economy like Bolivia's or Ecuador's?
I think it could be easier, yeah, where there's sort of a vacuum of information. People are not, first of all, that interested. So there's not a lot of information. So if you're well connected, like he is with the media, he's a former financial journalist, you can sort of plant some seeds and rumors get moving. Absolutely. I mean, I think something like that, as I said, is happening right now in Bolivia with mining operations that are under threat of being nationalized. And there's a lot of speculation as to whether it'll actually happen or not.
Well, why would it not happen?
Well, there's a sense that maybe Evo will... I was just reading an article about this yesterday. There's a sense that maybe he is talking big game for political reasons because he's playing to his base, but maybe he will he'll sort of back away from it, or he'll be – I mean, he exempts certain companies for – I don't know why, but and so maybe he'll back away from the more hardline positions.
Well, sometimes the government doesn't do the job as well as an experienced company. In other cases, you might – also assume that there's been some money that has exchanged hands to prevent the takeover. You make La Paz sound rather dreary, yet Gabriel's on the verge of falling in love with Bolivia. What appeals to him so strongly?
I think there's a sense of he falls in love with it when he's in college, and I think he feels liberated from the kind of he's going to Brown University, and I think he feels liberated from the sense of pressure. There's a kind of less of the kind of ambition, the sort of feverish ambition that drives people. He gets away from that when he's there.
Well, it's a landlocked country, and yet it has a navy?
They do have a navy, yes.
Where do they sail the navy?
I'm not entirely sure, but they have a naval base, yeah, in La Paz. I guess Lake Titicaca, perhaps. I'm not entirely sure.
You describe the light as being different in La Paz because of the elevation, the thinness of the air.
Yeah.
Have you spent much time there?
Yeah, well, I have been a few times as research for this book.
So what is the light like?
It's an incredibly beautiful place in a way. I mean, it's a complex.
It's a colonial city, and they were gorgeous, weren't they? Especially one that was built on silver and gold.
Yes. Well, there's parts of it that remain that way, but a lot of it is more sort of buildings from the 70s. It's not – the architecture is not – remarkable or pretty, but the way the terrain is obviously breathtaking. I mean, you're at 12,000 feet up in the Andes. It's pretty gorgeous.
When it comes time for him to leave Bolivia, he realizes he's hardly seen the place.
Mm-hmm.
So how's he been spending his time other than eating salteñas?
He's been trying to do this job. I think that's kind of one of the many ways in which it's a sort of a the tragedy of what he does is he's so obsessed. I mean, he fell in love with Bolivia because he got away from his ambition, but there he is, just totally in the thrall of his ambition, and he doesn't even have a chance to go to the movies or anything.
And part of the suspense of the story is the question of just how completely he will sell out in the end.
Mm-hmm.
He also has an affair with a woman who lives with her ex-husband, mm-hmm, and his current wife. Is that because housing is tight?
Yeah, that's based on a family I knew in Ecuador, where the entire extended family, they all lived in this gigantic house. It wasn't like a nice house, but it was everyone lived there because it was cost effective, including ex-spouses and grandparents and aunts and uncles and everyone. There were maybe 20, 30 family members in the house.
This story, most of the Gabriel's life is shaped by women. There aren't all that many men here.
Yes. It's a funny thing because in reality, obviously, the financial world is often a very, very macho place. But in the book, I like the idea of Gabriel being, you know, he's surrounded by these women, these very, very powerful, confident, intelligent women, his mother, his girlfriend, his friend at the Wall Street Journal, Fiona, and his boss, Priya, who's the fund manager in Weehawken.
You've lived in New York and Los Angeles, but also Scotland, Sri Lanka, mm-hmm, Ecuador, Mexico.
Yeah.
What's led you to move around so much?
Well, during my adulthood.
You live in Seattle now?
I live in Seattle now. Yeah, I traveled a lot as an adult. I don't know. I don't entirely sure why. I just kind of kept going. When I was growing up, my father worked for the IMF, and so that was why we were in Sri Lanka for 3 years.
I'm sure the IMF experience also prepared you to some degree for thinking about this.
Yeah, I mean, it showed me a lot of the humanity of these people who are so frequently kind of cartoonized in literature. And I felt like I wanted to sort of reveal again in this book a lot of the ways in which people really are complicated, even though they work at a hedge fund or whatever, they're real people.
Peter Mountford will be giving a reading and signing books tomorrow night at 9 o'clock at DBA Brooklyn. That's at 113 North 7th Street between White Avenue and Berry Street in Williamsburg. His book, A Young Man's Guide to Late Capitalism, is published by Mariner. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.